Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte, episode number 25, Science Goes to Hollywood.
Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more information and to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 25, with Dr. Kiki and Leo Laporte. And today, we're talking about science going to Hollywood. What about the portrayal of science in the movies? Is the way it's portrayed good, bad, indifferent towards humanity?
I almost thought you said betrayal instead of portrayal. But in some ways, that might be the right word. Movies like Armageddon.
And recently, 2012. Yes. How movies portray science is a question that a lot of people have started thinking about recently, especially scientists and educators who are interested in having people understand more about science in the world. It's become the question of, do we always have to have science portrayed as the way science works for everyone to appreciate science and how it affects our lives on a daily basis, and how it will affect us going into the future. So the question is, how is science portrayed in the movies? Not betrayed, but portrayed. From the book website Hollywood Science, which is written by Dr. Sidney Perkowitz, our guest today.
There he is. I hear his voice.
He's there. Hello.
In the flesh, right?
a quote from their PR page about his book says, "Movies, especially science fiction films, temporarily remove viewers from the world as they know it and show them the world as it might be, providing special perspective on human nature and society. Yet Hollywood science can be erroneous, distorting fact for dramatic effect and stereotyping scientists as remote and nerdy, evil, or noble, doing little to improve the relationship between science and
society."
All
of them are kind of wrong, aren't they?
Yeah, and what is the true stereotype of a scientist?
There isn't any stereotype or the same stereotype that all of humanity has, right? That's the right answer.
Right.
Right.
Right. Scientists are just you and me.
Yes.
They're just us, not just folks.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. Two scientists on the line today, me and Sydney, can say that we're just like everybody else.
Right. We just picked a strange career path. It was the only big difference, right?
Exactly. And so, talking today, you have a really great interest. You're a physicist yourself, but you have an interest in science and the movies. How did you, what brought you into kind of putting science together with the movies and writing a book and having this become something that you're really interested in?
Well, partly it's lifelong. Like a lot of scientists, I like science fiction. Most scientists seem to. I just know how science is done in science fiction from years of reading it and then seeing it in film. Then I wrote a book about robots, and there was one chapter about robots in the movies. So the next natural step was to write not just one chapter, but a whole book about science in the movies. That's how it evolved.
It's funny that you should say that, because Jerry Pournelle, who's a great science fiction writer, was on our show, TWiT show, on Sunday. And I brought that up. I said I thought that a lot of scientists got their inspiration from sci-fi. And he said, well, I don't think Einstein read any sci-fi. But scientists, I guess, in the late 20th century and the 21st century certainly are a lot influenced by, I would expect, are a lot influenced by, not just science fiction books, but by their portrayal in science fiction and media and movies.
Yeah. A lot of anecdotal evidence that says that. I've heard that guys at NASA who launch rockets love to sit around and look at old science fiction flicks. It's their form of relaxation. The science is wrong, but they still enjoy the recognition, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you can hear explosions in Star Wars, but I think Star Wars still encouraged a lot of scientists to get into, you know, field space exploration and other fields.
Yeah.
Absolutely true, yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, part of the book that you've written looks at science in the movies from a historical perspective. So if we look at science in the movies and movies becoming a much larger part of our culture and the way we look at the world and what and the information we get from the world, you know, how have you seen various movies becoming more influential?
Well, first of all, the impact has become just beyond huge. Science fiction was seen as kind of a second-rate form of movie making until 2001 and Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Then it's just exploded. Mm-hmm. So now, if you look at the 20 or 30 top grossing movies of all time, about one-third of them are science fiction flicks. Mm-hmm. So now science fiction movies reach lots and lots and lots of people, way beyond any book Einstein wrote or any other scientist ever wrote. So the impact just is there automatically. And then even in academia, even in universities, you now start to see courses in science fiction. So it's taken a lot more seriously than it used to be. That's a big part of what's changed.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is, go ahead, Kiki.
No, you go. It's fine.
Another interesting thing, I just want to point this out while I think of it. When I was a teenager and read science fiction, this wasn't something that women ever got involved in.
That's true, yeah.
Now you see a lot of female science fiction writers, some of the best, and female science fiction fans. So you're now bringing in half of the populace that didn't used to be involved in this at all.
Yeah, well, let's look at the characterization of scientists in movies. Have the number of female scientists increased?
It's still not huge, but it's gotten a little better. You can think of some films in the last 10 years or 15 years that have had female scientists. There was something called Chain Reaction about fusion power, which had Rachel Weisz playing a very beautiful and also accomplished physicist, and Elizabeth Shuey has played a woman who's discovered cold fusion, and everyone's favorite is Jodie Foster in Contact.
Yeah.
If you ask most scientists, they'll agree that that's one of the more realistic portrayals of how a scientist operates. So there are a few.
Do you think the majority of portrayals are inaccurate? How many scientists really act like the scientists in movies, and how many of the
yeah. I'm laughing. Thank God, not too many. That's my first response. Well, yeah, right. He's got it. He's got the maniacal laugh down pat. We just need to put a ray gun in his hand. He can rule the world.
You fools!
You fools! Yes.
Yeah.
You ignorant fools. Usually that's the modifier.
Was Dr. Right. Frankenstein, I suppose in some ways, he might have been an early prototype of the mad scientist.
You know, he was, but if you look at the movie recently, which maybe you haven't, but I did from my book, his reasons for doing it are not so crazy. He just wants to know what's over the horizon.
Yeah.
And one thing that's over the horizon is, could man create life? So there's kind of an interesting scientific goal there, but he sure overdid it. Let's leave it in those
okay,
terms.
He went too far.
Yeah.
I can't agree with his means, but his motives were pure.
The end was good, yes. But the means not so cool. Yeah.
He sidestepped the academic review board.
Yeah.
For sure. Actually, his old PhD advisor or MD advisor told him, Dr. Frankenstein, actually his first name in the movie is Henry, believe it or not, said, Henry, don't push this, that you're pushing the bounds. But he ignored that advice and went ahead and did it anyway.
It just shows you the power of the movies that we're talking about him as if he were a real person.
Isn't that something? Right. And, you know, if there's one known scientist in the whole world after Albert Einstein, it's probably Henry Frankenstein. Unfortunately.
Who never existed.
You're right.
The made-up scientist character. I'm just thinking about all the different scientist characters that I've seen in different movies. There was Jeff Goldblum's character in The Fly.
Yes, yeah, I liked him.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. Him. And he's also in Jurassic Park.
That's right, yeah. Well, he wears glasses, and we know that All scientists wear glasses. So, you know, when you need a guy to play a scientist, you look for the guy who wears glasses.
Right. And then in
and
the
that's
action
another
scene.
Place.
Go ahead, Kiki. Sydney. All right.
I'm jumping on your. That's another place Kiki and I are not typical.
You're not wearing glasses. Where are your glasses? I'm not sure I trust you guys. Are you really scientists?
We're not real. We got our PhDs from Diploma Mill, right? Online. Mine came online. I don't know about yours.
And I don't see any lab coats. I don't see any white coats here or anything like that.
Well, I'm at home. I don't wear mine at home. Okay. It would freak out my wife.
But you do have a lab coat.
I have a lab coat.
Actually, right. No. Because Kiki's a bioscientist, but right. Physicists don't wear them.
No.
Right. I mean, and the functional reality of lab coats is that it keeps you from spilling things on your clothes. That's basically why people wear lab coats, so you don't get things on you that could harm you or stain your clothes. And it's just that's it. Just functional purpose.
It's pretty straightforward.
Very straightforward.
Yeah. It also shows that, unlike the stereotype, it shows you're socially aware. You don't want to go out to dinner later with a stained dress, right?
There you go.
You're aware that looking good is important.
That's why I wear pocket protectors.
Oh, of course.
Right. But I'm not a scientist. I have glasses and pocket protectors. I'm a nerd. That's close to a scientist.
I think we could give you a PhD in a second.
A nerd is a scientist without a degree.
Right.
That's all. Yeah.
Right.
Do you think that we have, there's been a change in, are there fewer mad scientists these days, or do you think there are more mad scientists these days?
In the movies, we should say.
In the movies.
Let's limit it to that. Thank you for that modification. I actually think there are fewer. A trend that you see now is heroic scientists, which is kind of surprising. In fact, the director who has done some of the biggest disaster films, Roland Emmerich, had two or three in a row with truly heroic, ethically engaged scientists. So I think that's a trend that's popping up. And I think it's partly because we're now 50 years after the atomic bomb, so you can't blame the scientists anymore for putting nuclear power into the world, and maybe they're beginning to get a little bit of a pass. They can do good things, in other words.
Yeah. Have you put together cultural changes, so things like the development of nuclear bomb, the atomic bomb, nuclear power, the changes in the way that the public generally perceives science and scientists and correlated that with how the movies are portraying them? Is that
Absolutely. The movies track that. I'm not sure that the average screenwriter sits down and says, I'm going to make sure to get in a message about nuclear power, but it's in the air. So the screenwriter knows about it. It shows up one way or another. And in fact, to push on with the idea that nuclear scientists now get a pass, if there is a villain these days, it tends to be a bioscientist.
Oh, that's true.
For instance, someone who's doing illegitimate cloning or cloning for really unethical reasons. So the movies track the way people think about science, and at some level they track science and society in general.
Right. Do you think that, have there been any movies you think that are leading opinion?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, you could argue some of the cloning movies, because after all, human cloning is still a long way off, if ever. So they're building on just a little bit of real science, like cloning Dolly and some dogs and so on, and projecting to where it might take human cloning. So yeah, at some level they do lead.
Your opinion is not valid.
Yeah.
Just ignore me. I'm trying to log into our talking.
we're trying to put together an interactive conversation. We've got some people who have asked questions and made comments in video form, and we've also got an audio chat room, and we're going to see how that works in a couple of minutes to see if people can ask some questions.
We're crazy. Just call us crazy.
Yeah, and to remind everyone who's out there listening right now that you can join us in our talking chat room.
Yes.
Twitter,
there's a bunch of people in there. Say hello, Twalkin' folks.
Twalkin'. And the address for that is twalk.in.
Oh, I know what the problem is. We're hearing degraded audio.
He's talking back to us.
It's the last one.
twalk.in, and it is the forward slash T. I have it here somewhere.
I know, I tweeted it.
I give you the phone number, 218-548-9255. The PIN number is 523 if you'd like to join us. The problem is that I think that I cannot control how
people get to talk.
Yeah, I think everybody talks at once.
That's what I was saying. It's a cluster talk.
Yeah, so I don't know how that's going to be.
Yeah, well, we have some video stuff too. Let's see. So I wanted to move on to so we've kind of covered the mad scientist representation in the movie, in the movies. Let's talk about some of the, I mean, one of the big issues in discussing how science is portrayed is whether or not movies are completely screwing up the science and if that is bad for public understanding of science.
You can't give a simple one sentence answer to that. The movies do screw up the science, but after I'd seen 120 of them for my book,
wow,
I decided, it was kind of mind boggling. I didn't watch any science fiction for 2 or 3 months after that. I'd had my fill, for sure. But I came away deciding it wasn't as bad as I thought. And a more accurate way to put it is there's not a movie that doesn't start with a basic scientific idea and then they hype it. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how far does the hyping go? For instance, a movie that I really liked because of the issue it dealt with was A Day After Tomorrow, which is about global warming. That's mm-hmm. a Roland Emmerich.
Another catastrophe film.
Yeah, right. And obviously it was practiced for 2012 because it uses some of the same approach, right. But 2012 does it many times more intensely. Anyway, global warming is real. At least that's the majority of what scientists think. And all the effects shown in the movie, including the fact that global warming could cause an ice age, are true. So that stuff was not made up. What was made up was how fast it happens.
Right.
So that's where you hit that point, science versus creating an interesting story. And obviously, the movies want to sell tickets. They need a good story. They need to do some hyping. Yeah. So I don't think that's entirely bad. It's kind of the nature of the beast.
2 hours of watching an iceberg melt, not really compelling.
They would have sold 3 tickets.
Yeah, you're not going to sell
the director's mother,
tickets.
Maybe. Yeah,
exactly.
It's one of those art house films.
What in your opinion, though, of the films, of the 125 films, was there one that actually got it right, did a pretty good job?
You know, they get it right more often than just a straight science, and I also think it's more important. There are hardly any that got all the science. Well, I'll take that back. There's a movie from the 1950s called Destination Moon. It's based on a Heinlein story, Robert Heinlein, of the first moonshot.
Wow.
And Heinlein was a technical advisor.
Oh, that's neat.
So they got every last detail right. He was really stubborn about that. He never gave an inch. Every technical detail is right, but the movie's kind of boring. they forgot about putting in a story. There is a story, but it's not presented very dramatically at all. Yeah. So I think that's a great illustration that you scratch the average scientist, will say, well, the most important thing is to get all the science right. Not from the movie maker's viewpoint. You really have to find a balance between the two.
I think that's a really important point, because why do people go see movies? They want to be entertained by a story. And so there has to be something that's really going to capture their attention for an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it has to be. And if you're just boring people with all the facts, ma'am, you know, it's not going to work.
Or another way to put it is, would you rather get across some partial science and maybe start someone thinking because they're willing to sit there for 2 hours as they're being entertained, mm-hmm. or have them not go to the film at all? And I think I'd vote for plan A rather than plan B out of those two. Yeah.
Yeah. What about recent movies? So getting people thinking, 2012. This is the one that's on everybody's lips these days. You know, it is the season's blockbuster. And you know, blockbusters, they come with lots of bangs and bells and whistles and that sort of stuff.
I don't think you could have less science in a movie than 2012. I mean, it's based on the Mayan calendar. What happens makes no sense. And I haven't seen it. It's just from the trailer.
You
know. It makes no sense at all. What, the Earth is erupting suddenly?
It's 2012. It's the alarm clock.
You want an explanation? It's mutated neutrinos. Everyone knows that.
Of course.
That's right.
I always forget the mutated neutrinos.
Yeah, yeah.
When in doubt.
It's easy for the non-scientists to forget that, but we scientists worry about it a lot.
You know, actually, I'm thinking that a movie that might have, in a way, been gotten what little science there was in it right would be War of the Worlds, going back. There had been several versions, but the most recent version. Mm-hmm. In, I hope I'm not spoiling for anybody, but the aliens invade. They have devastating weapons. They're overwhelming, but they're killed by a microbe.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's, I think, not only poignant, but probably not so inaccurate.
Actually, NASA has worried about what its space probes will bring back to Earth that might be alien microbes. So it's kind of the inverse of the situation right. that you just described. Right. Seems reasonably plausible. But, you know, that raised a great point. You said there were several versions of War of the Worlds. The original one in the 50s had a lot more science than the Tom Cruise version.
Oh, that's too bad.
The lead scientist actually sits down and explains why the Martians might be at risk and talks about how Martians differ from Earthlings and so on. And the Tom Cruise version basically doesn't have any science in it except for the way the Martians die at the end.
And you're probably just supposed to have figure out that it died because of a bad germ.
That's right. I don't even think it's said all that clearly.
They don't explain
that's
it. Right. Could have been a bad burrito for all they said. I mean,
just remember, don't use the salsa bar.
Yeah. that's another story.
That's our secret weapon. Forever invaded. That will have signs that say, this way to the burritos. That'll do it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. Maybe some of the more recent remakes of movies, as we get more CGI, bigger effects, better effects, we can rely more on the bombs, the explosions, the laser beams, than having to rely on the actual underlying science, because they're just, maybe the movie makers are keeping people entertained with the bells and whistles as opposed to, you know, actual substance underneath.
A lot of truth in that. I mean, the CGI is a beautiful thing. When you see a movie that does a really awe-inspiring tsunami, you just see the power of these special effects. You could not do it without modern computation and graphics and so on. But I believe it's pushing out stories and characters in some films. People apparently will pay $8 or $10 just to see enormous special effects. Another pet peeve of mine, which is related to that, is 2012 ran 2 hours and 38 minutes. It really did not need to run that long. You could have said, oh, wow, for 2 hours or 1 hour and 50 minutes, and that would have been plenty. Movies back in the 50s typically ran 90 or 100 minutes, and that was plenty. So I don't think we need these long travelogues of special effects to have a powerful movie.
Yeah, maybe they're making them longer to make people feel better about spending $8 to $10.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah, that's my theory.
$50 night at the movies.
Yeah, 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 yeah. A movie date now is not a cheap date. It's a big deal. If you're a college student, it's a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah, it absolutely is. I think there's also CGI also has the ability to, I don't know, maybe make things clearer to people than it would have been otherwise, or maybe to enhance certain aspects of a possible future reality, even considering science fiction. So in addition to the ability to make a big towering tsunami that's going to awe you for, you know, the couple of minutes that it takes to wipe out a small village in Indonesia, it's, you know, there are other things that could be that are really beneficial that we couldn't do before that we can do now.
It's an imagination tool. I mean, if you look at any of the Star Wars movies, just what the sets look like, the city of the future, or what the desert would look like on an alien planet, is done, or the aliens themselves, all of that is done fantastically well. So that's a tool that just expands imagination. I just think it shouldn't take over the whole movie. You still need characters at some point and a plot at some point.
Yeah. One recent movie that I really enjoyed was District 9, which I think
used CGI very
well, and then it also added like the human factor.
It was a political movie, really, in a way.
Yeah, it was science fiction,
but it was talking about apartheid.
More politics.
Was there? How about the science in that? I mean, this must be an interesting part of your job, Sydney, is imagining alien races and what. what kinds of, you know, things they, is it reasonable to assume that they might look like they did, that might have the reactions that they did, that I guess we can't really know.
It's pretty wide open, and I think that's a nice part of it. So if I told you which planet the aliens come from and tell you the gravity, for instance, and how hot the sun is, you could set some broad boundaries. For instance, if it's a heavy gravity planet, you might think they'd be kind of short and squat, that kind of thing. But but outside of that, they're huge ranges. So one thing that the film showed about the aliens was they had a family structure. These creatures that were so strange looking to us, well, the father still loved this kid. He really wanted to be involved with this kid, and there's no reason that that shouldn't be possible. Most species on Earth have some kind of relationship between parents and their offspring, so why shouldn't aliens? So that that made a lot of sense to me, and it added to the story. It added a level of emotional understanding of what the aliens were all about.
Well, I love that movie. I hope we haven't spoiled it for anybody. I don't think we have.
I don't think we've given anything away yet.
No. Yeah, never mind.
That movie is part of a trend that I wrote a blog about this. We're seeing more science fiction from a viewpoint other than the U.S. viewpoint. The big science fiction hits have all been Hollywood products, and that's great. Hollywood does it very well. But District 9 has a South African background, which tells you something about the politics that you want to think about as you look at the movie. I saw a movie called Sleep Dealer, which is about a future world where Mexican immigrants absolutely cannot get into the U.S. and how they use technology to get around that. Fascinating movie and a whole different perspective. The immigrant problem from the Latin American side rather than from the American side. And I'd love to see this kind of thing expand. I think we need more science fiction that has kind of a global view involved.
We're going to, I want to take a little break here for an ad, Sydney. So
okay.
I noticed you had a cup of something there.
I'll sip. It's just lemonade.
Okay.
I'll keep my reputation intact.
You have anything you want.
Thank you.
And we're going to come back. We do have some questions from Vidley. I'm going to have to punt on the talking. First of all, people couldn't really hear very well. Something about our audio into there was distorted, and I couldn't think of any way that we could make it be one person at a time.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And you know how that is if everybody talks at once. So,
no good for the audio.
Okay.
The radio
we'll start with the video. But if you want to send us a video, folks, go to vid.ly, leave a video, and then as part of the process of creating a video there, you can tweet, and all you have to do is use the hashtag #DKSH. And what I'm doing is I am searching for videos via that hashtag on Twitter. So #DK, Dr. Kiki, Science Hour, SH. This show is brought to you by Ford Sync. The great folks at Ford have made an amazing hands-free music player, phone controller. I don't know what to even call it. It's a computer in your car. And it is, in my opinion, and I've been using it now for a few weeks. I got mine, must have been a month ago. It is, in my opinion, simply the best in-car computer system I've ever used. Amazing what it can do. First of all, safety is paramount. So the idea behind Ford Sync is you never take your eyes off the road or your hands off the wheel. There's a button on the wheel. You press it. It goes boonk. And then I have it set to the advanced mode where it doesn't give me commands because I know how to use it. But it'll give you prompts. It gives you great prompts. So you're never at sea. And you can say things like navigation, directions, point of interest, Starbucks, and it'll take you to Starbucks. You can say work, and it learns your route to work, to home, to school. It even will monitor traffic along that route and reroute you or warn you. Traffic's bad. It's turn-by-turn directions, but it's full GPS, but it's not one of those expensive GPS in-car GPS systems. There's no big screen. It talks you through it. You know, there is, a 2 or 3 line LED screen. It's really vehicle health reports. If your airbags are deployed, it's got a 911 assist. It'll automatically call 911 on your phone and send them GPS coordinates. Plays a recorded message, sends them GPS coordinates, and gives you the chance to talk to 911 if you're conscious. But if you're not, they're on their way. Personalized news, sports, and weather. Great for people who love podcasts. It works with the Zune, the Nano, the iPod, the Droid, almost any kind of USB device, if it can see the MP3s, it can read the tags, it can index it. You can say things like, play Dr. Kiki's Science Hour number 25. It'll play it. You can say, play the Beatles. You can say, play similar. You can say, play next, play previous. You can say, repeat. I can go on and on, but I think the best thing to do is to visit the website, SyncMyRidePodcast.com. You'll get more information there and information about our contest. We're giving away 15 Nanos and 15 Zunes between now and December 8th. Actually, December 9th. So you have a few more days. All you have to do is tweet. When you're doing the Vidly, add to the pound DKSH, pound Sync My Ride Podcast, and you're automatically entered to win. They're giving away one a day from now through December 9th. But find out more at SyncMyRidePodcast.com. I'm a big fan. I've got to take my... I brought my camera in today. In fact, I was going to get in the car and do a video so I can show you. So by next week, Kiki, we'll have a video and I can show you how the Ford Sync works. It's amazing. Great. Have you been in the car yet?
You
filled it up with gas. Thank you. Next time, can you wash it? There's a... I got a wash card in the glove compartment there. You can get a wash anytime.
I'll keep that in mind for the next time I go in a Mustang.
I like to keep it clean. Yeah, I like to keep it clean. So, all right, let me see if we can get these Vidlies. There are not very many. In fact, I think there's only one at this point.
No, there are a couple.
There are more.
Let me see if I can look at my list.
I've created a search for DKSH.
I know.
Comment about computers and films. Here's one.
Yes.
Let's get this one on.
One, turn up the volume. Three.
Oh, there's quite a few. Well, let's go. Here's the first one.
Hey, Dr. Kiki and Leo. I just want to say I cannot stand the depiction of computers in film.
You take
a movie like War Games, over 25 years old, one of the most accurate depictions of computers in film to date. You take a more recent movie like Hackers, it's so overblown, you have a hard time finding anything that is accurate in the movie. I was just wondering what your comment is on computers in film.
This is good. He even has videos with him.
Yeah.
So War Games. Oh, he said, what do you think about computers and films? He said, War Games, really accurate. John Badham's film about computers. Mm-hmm. But then he said, Hackers, not so accurate. I'm thinking of movies like Colossus, The Forbin Project. Did you include that kind of movie, Dr.
Perkins? Yes. That movie is still scary.
I love it. I don't know how accurate it is, but I love it.
It's a winner.
Is it?
It's a winner. I teach a course in science and film. We make sure our students see that one.
Really?
It's a great film.
I thought it was kind of lesser known. I'm really glad to hear that. I've always loved that movie.
Well, I'm trying to make it famous. Between the two of us, we can do it.
but one thing people do complain about with computers is the user interfaces. They don't look real. Text is always really big. But, you've got to – I'm sure you talk about this in your book. You've got to make allowances, as you said, for Hollywood. They're telling a story. They're not trying to be accurate about science or computers or technology.
You know, the average lab or computer room is not that exciting a place. I think Hollywood is within their rights in hyping it up a little bit.
Yeah.
If you're in the area, if you're a true computer scientist or physicist, you say, oh, no, it's not like that. But again, it's part of the entertainment, so I don't have a big problem with that.
No, yeah. I'm trying to think of, Matrix, The Matrix, that's...
That's a computer-based.
It is part of the digital world. Of a whole genre of movies, Terminator as well, where the machines have won. The singularity has happened. The machines have taken over, and now humans are fighting back. A popular genre, I'd imagine, because we're all terrified of these computers and machines.
Right.
Is that a credible scenario?
Those films are getting at.
Yeah.
The average robot now is about as intelligent as a cockroach. So we've got a long way to go before you have the Terminators that can actually pass for human and do all kinds of interesting things. Not that the roboticists are not doing wondrous things, but there's still a long, long way to go. I put those movies as portraying a far distant future.
Right.
When I say far distant, I mean maybe 20 or 30 years, we might have something approaching.
iRobot, there's another one that's along those lines.
Another one, right.
Absolutely right. Not true to Isaac Asimov's vision, but still a great, I thought a pretty good movie with Will Smith. So, go ahead.
A thought provoker. Makes you think about the ethics of robots and of having robots and so on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Are you not with Ray Kurzweil that in his thinking that the singularity is near?
I believe he thinks that will sooner or later become more the human race will sooner or later become more machine than human. I'm not quite sure I see the point of that, but where I do see it is in medicine. We have so many people who, for medical reasons, are cyborgs. I'm one myself because I have a pacemaker right here.
Yeah.
So in a technical sense, I'm a cyborg, and I think we'll see more and more medicine where organic functions are taken over by machines. We'll have artificial skin, eyes, hearing, whatever. I think that's a true and significant trend.
And then there's the addition of that, the organic organic medicine that's going on. So the changes in technology where it's not necessarily artificial skin, but skin
right.
that's been grown especially
right.
to fit you, that it, you know, organs that are grown to fit you, or even nanotech devices, mm-hmm. little tiny
right.
robots, but that are designed with an organic basis to them, you know, so that they will fit into your body and not be kicked out by the immune system. So there's going to be, I think, this real interesting balance between the actual technology, what we think of as like silicon chips and electronics and that sort of stuff, versus more on the organic side with the carbon-based
life
platform.
Forms. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
too much Star Trek.
Yeah. Or even the use of bacteria, microbes to help us. You know?
We've got another. You want to take another video from Vidley?
Yes, please.
You know, say your, when, by the way, a note, I could see your name, but I never remember it between the time that I put the video on and the time it ends. So if you record a video, say your name at the beginning. Say who you are and introduce yourself so that we know. You can just use your first name. Say where you're calling from, too.
Hello, Leo. Dr. Kiki. Dr. Kiki, you have read a few of my stories on This Week in Science. I'm that David from Durham.
David from Durham.
Nice. Hello, David.
Babylon 5. They did something very interesting in that for their ship movements and their CGI, they decided to use real physics, and they discovered something absolutely amazing. Doing it right is easier than doing it wrong. I would also like your guest to talk a little bit about why Hollywood seems to be allergic to communication delay.
It takes too much
that
time.
Is, if you are talking to someone who is on the moon, it takes 2.5 to 3 seconds before that communication to make its round trip.
Yeah.
In space battles, I've never seen one on the movies done at any distance. Seems to me they would, because the distance we fire now on our surface navy is a lot farther than they do in the movies.
That's true. They're always close up battles.
Harrington series books in our reading,
right.
They fire at 10
right.
million kilometers. That means a laser beam would take 33 and a third seconds to get there, and another 33 and a third seconds for the light from what happened to get back to you. I challenge Hollywood to do this.
This is,
well, yeah, of course,
David loves the dramatic pause, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah, yes, pause. Good at it. I think you could do some script writing yourself. Well, David, I think you know the answer. Your numbers are absolutely correct, but the audience is not going to sit around and wait for 3 or 4 seconds between every two phrases in a conversation. That's just all there is to it.
You know,
so I believe Hollywood has to make that little dramatic adjustment.
I do think, though, that as I remember in Kubrick's 2001, there was a slight delay in the video calls,
right.
And I thought that it wasn't adequate. It wasn't a long enough delay, but I thought it was a nice touch. And by the way,
that movie was already long enough.
Kubrick didn't mind delaying things. Believe me, he was a slow paced director. But he also all of the scenes with rockets in space were silent, and I loved that. I thought he made a virtue out of that, while being scientifically accurate. Just my 2 cents worth. We were talking about dystopias. What about genetics in the movies? I'm thinking of Gattaca, for instance.
Gattaca.
Oh, I'm so glad you. I put that among my all-time 10 best science fiction movies.
Wow.
Because I thought it did such a great job of projecting where overuse of DNA knowledge could take us. I thought this movie hit a home run, not so much in the science. Some of the science is wrong or pushed a little too far, but I'm projecting how science might hit society. And just the other day, I read an ad from a commercial company that says, we will match you with your prospective mate if you both send us your DNA samples.
Huh.
So there was Gattaca. There was Gattaca in the flesh.
Right.
Because that's what happens in that movie.
That's right.
Maybe you want to say a few words about the movie for viewers who don't know about it, because it's not as well known as it deserves to be, or I'd be glad to.
I have a soft spot in my heart for it because it was filmed right here at the Marin Civic Center.
That's right. I forgot that. Yeah.
A very famous Frank Lloyd Wright building that looks like it's in the future. Looks like a spaceship that landed, but it's also kind of a retro, a 1930s kind of a future spaceship.
Yeah, if you want to go ahead and say, give a brief summary of the film.
Go ahead, Sydney, because it's been a while since I saw it. All I really remember is he kept scrubbing himself with a brush to eliminate any shedding of genetic material.
Don't shed any genetic material.
Don't
People
shed.
Could pick it up and Neither. Sequence you.
They will nail you down. It's set a little bit in the future. A lot of it is recognizable, but it looks a bit modernistic. For instance, there are electric cars and solar power. And the premise is that they reached a point where DNA testing can be done very cheaply and right on the spot. So if you meet someone and can get a sample of their saliva, you just go to the DNA testing center. They'll tell you what kind of a person he is. And they also categorize you on the basis of a DNA test when you're born. So it's a kind of stratified society. There's really an oblique movie about racism, among other things. And the hero is a young man who's born with some defects but decides he wants to become an astronaut and go into space. And the movie really soars because he works at how to beat the DNA testing and achieve his human potential. That's what makes it quite a beautiful movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, Daryl Petey in our chat room says that what makes good science fiction is not predicting the future, not where our science is going, but predicting where our society is going.
Absolutely. That's a great movie. That would make a great movie. You can even get the science a little bit wrong. That's not that important.
Yep, because we care about people, ultimately. Science is about its application and how it affects our lives and so forth. Although also our innate desire to know. And certainly a lot of science fiction is, like Contact, is about knowing. Even 2001 is about kind of knowing, well, what's it all about? You know, it's that, you know, why are we here thing.
Yeah. With the Gattaca situation, understanding who we are and what makes us who we are.
Right.
What are those instructions really saying? What do they include?
We're so close to that instant analysis.
And the thing is, that's true. I mean, how fast we can sequence DNA now and how much it costs is ridiculous.
It's
right
like Moore's,
now.
It's Moore's Law is impacting it.
I think $5,000 is the most recent number value that came out like a week or so ago, and it takes a couple of weeks to sequence the entire, a single person's entire genome. That within the next year, it's going to be, I'm guessing the next year, two at the max. I don't see it being any more than 2 years, but it will be available $100 genome sequencing that will take place in 24 hours.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
So Gattaca is happening. I happened to be at dinner at an event a year or so ago. I sat next to Craig Venter, who is Mr. DNA, or maybe I should say Dr. DNA. He's the guy who got the human genome sequenced. I asked him what he thought of Gattaca, and he said he found that a very impressive science fiction movie because it took the science and projected it in a reasonable way, kind of a believable way.
Yeah,
and as Kiki just said, it's happening.
It is happening. And all I have to say is thank goodness we have the Congress. It took them 13 years to pass it. But thank goodness they have passed the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, which is a big step in keeping a Gattaca-like future from occurring.
Yay.
But one other point to make is that these movies, as we're saying, don't always get the science right. And that's where the teaching moment comes. So Gattaca implies if you know the DNA, you know everything about a person. But that's actually not correct.
Right.
There's a lot of other stuff going on that you can put under the heading of nurture or gene expression. So when we also use that film in my science and film course, we make sure the students understand that DNA is only part of the story. So there's a double-barreled message there, which is really a great message to get across.
We have time for one more video from Stan A to Z. You ready, kids?
Stan
A to Z.
Oh. Hey, Dr. Kiki and Leo. This is Stan A to Z out in Ventura, California. One of the biggest faux pas I see in every sci-fi movie that has a spaceship dogfight scene is why do the spaceships have to bank when they turn? You know, it looks really cool, and it's kind of reminiscent of the old World War II dogfight movies and whatnot, but totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
And engines don't make noise in space either unless you're inside the spaceship. some thoughts. Anyway, love the idea. Enjoy the shows.
In space, no one can see you bank.
What do you think, right, Sydney? You're the physicist.
You don't have to bank.
Why don't you have to bank?
You don't have to bank because banking has to do with gravity and also how the atmosphere is affecting you. So in space, it seems to me you could do a completely flat turn if you're out in gravity-free area. But I remember reading that when the first Star Wars came out, part of the inspiration was not just science fiction, but World War One fighter plane movies.
Right.
Where you do have a guy in a machine gun tracking a ship optically. Yeah. Imagine doing that in space at the speed of a spaceship.
Couldn't do it.
And also with these great banking turns and the sense of a dogfight. And if you think back to the first Star Wars, that's how the fights are portrayed. Sure. They're dogfights in space. So what? I think we're just copying that image of how fighter planes operate, but there's little or no physical reality to it.
One related thing that always bugs me is the fact that they never show the real effect of acceleration. I guess they've just assumed that we couldn't have space travel unless we were able to counter acceleration, because in most of these movies, you'd be a splat on the back wall of the spaceship if it really accelerated like it does, right?
Or at the very least, it would distort your features. So you start with the handsome or beautiful actress, actor or actress. You ruin their looks. That's not going to be in the cards. You can't do that.
Because you don't lose mass in space. You may not have gravity, but you still have your mass.
You do.
You got your mass. Yep.
That's something good.
And it gets even bigger.
So there was something. There was another video that yesterday I saw. Someone asked, in terms of teaching moments, I think another one that's good, we brought up Jurassic Park earlier. The question was, could we really take the DNA out of an insect preserved in amber?
Oh, that's a great question.
And stick it into, you know, an egg or whatever it happened to be and create another organism? Are we there? Can we do it? Is it possible?
You know, I really went into this in my book because it's such an interesting question, and it seems so plausible. You just wish it were true. So here's the story. They have found DNA almost as old as the DNA in that movie, 50, 60 million year old insect DNA.
Yeah.
But it ends up being really, really degraded. It's not very usable. So that's problem one. Problem two, even if the old DNA is good, you need to find an egg of the right species. In Jurassic Park, they put the DNA from dinosaurs in ostrich eggs, but there's no guarantee that an ostrich egg will support the development of a dinosaur. Among other things, you don't know what baby dinosaurs and embryos and so on ate 50, 60, 75 million years ago. Do we even have the right diet? So as far as I can tell from the research I did, it sounds plausible, but it's not quite doable.
Yeah,
sad to say.
I think the most recent idea, I think there were some Japanese researchers, it's not an insect, and it's the DNA is more recent, but taking mammoth DNA and being able to bring back the mammoth, because we could implant it into either an elephant. I think they were talking about implanting an elephant.
With a mammoth embryo?
With a mammoth embryo.
I'm
all for that.
Creating a clone egg.
I'd pay to see that, wouldn't you?
Sure.
I'd go to see the mammoth.
No saber-toothed tigers, but mammoths, okay. Yeah.
Even that. But a mammoth is only 25 or 50,000 years old as compared to 50 million. So that helps the condition of the DNA a lot. Also, it's been kept in cold storage because these animals live in the cold regions of the Earth. So all of that helps.
Right.
Yeah.
Sydney, this has been so much fun.
It is.
It's been great.
The website is sydneyperkowitz.net. I guess this all started with a pair of articles you wrote, Hollywood Physics for Physics World and Female Scientists on the Big Screen for The Scientist. And now, then it became a book in 2007, Hollywood Science.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to read it. I'm actually going to order this. It's fantastic.
Let me throw in a small plug. The hardcover came out in 2007, but it'll be out in paperback this coming February. Cheaper,
yay,
folks. If you want to read it, wait till the bargain copy comes out.
We'll make sure to let people know when it comes out in paperback.
It's so very generous of you, Sydney. Give up all those royalties.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I'm not going to retire on these royalties, guys.
Well,
this was great fun. Anytime you want to ask me back, I'm up for it.
Well, anytime we can talk about sci-fi movies and science, I'm all for that. I think that's a lot of fun.
Maybe we can bring you back next time there's a big sci-fi movie that comes out. We can do a commentary.
Next blockbuster.
Next blockbuster.
It'd be fun.
Thank you, Dr. Perkowitz.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both.
Take care.
Great job.
Yeah.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye, Sydney. See you later.
Yeah, now I want to watch that movie Gattaca again. I forgot all about that.
That was Dr. Sydney Perkowitz from Emory University and his book, Hollywood Science. And it'll be coming out in paperback in February. If you want to reach him or check out his stuff, like Leo said, sydneyperkowitz.net. And I am Dr. Kiki, and you can find me online, Twitter, at DRKIKI, or at Dr. Kiki, DRKIKI.TV is my blog. I'm all sorts of other places. My radio show, This Week in Science, is every Tuesday, and you can get lots more sciencey goodness there. And I will be back here next week with you, Leo, and the science comedian.
We're going to have the science comedian on because you heard Ray telling jokes from the science. He was stealing from the science comedian. And I said, I think you should be careful because I think he's going to be on the show soon.
He is next week.
I'll have my rim shot
ready. He's actually going to be in here in studio.
Well, I guess we'll be laughing.
Live.
Do you want to take Vidley's for him?
Yes. And I want Vidley's. I'm pushing this forward.
I think this is great. We got three, I thought, great questions. And we got to see the people who were asking the question. Yeah. It really worked. I think that was a success. I'm sorry, Twalkin did not work. I'll figure that out a little bit better. I think it has unfortunately, it has the same problem we were having with TalkShoe. But Vidley. And then we see you.
We see you. We're able to find them. And if you get your videos in ahead of time, you know, I'll have a chance to look through them and, you know, try and pick the best ones for the show.
Vid.ly.
Don't put it off. The science comedian. We're talking about finding humor in science, the fun in science. We're going to have
that
a lot of joking
great.
Fun questions. If you have any science jokes of your own, feel free to tell them.
Oh, that's what you should record
on
Vidley. Record a Vidley science joke. That's a great idea. A virus walks into a bar. Just a joke. Start a joke that begins like that. Just finish it.
That's one of the science comedian's jokes, and it's really funny. At least I find it humorous.
I think you're a nerd.
I'm a nerd. It's true.
I don't think it's that funny, but if you like it, I'm not going to knock it. All right, Doc. Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here, and we'll see you next time on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.